Path to Glory, the Warhammer Underworlds podcast that focuses on competitive gaming, player development, and community growth. I am your host, Aman Kusro, and I'm joined by my co-host, Zach Cachetta, a.k.a. Requisin. How's it going, my man?
I'm doing great. We get to talk about a brand new expansion.
Season, yes.
6½ dozen, but lots of changes to chat about, two new teams to chat about, two new rivals decks to chat about, and a rotation on top of it all, so it's going to be a good time.
Yeah, and I don't know if we're going to cover the rotation in this particular episode, just because of the way things have worked out, but we'll try to get an episode out at some point, but yeah.
We'll probably mention a couple cards here and there, like dominant position going away, but yeah, I don't know if we'll do the whole kit and caboodle right now, though.
Yeah, no, certainly not. The topic of today's episode is going over the Gnarlwood brand new season. This particular episode is going to be, I guess, part of a series because we're going to have 5 episodes drop the day of the Gnarlwood preview embargo release date. So I guess when it drops, you'll hear it. And this one specifically is going to talk about the rules changes to the Gnarlwood. So we're going to talk about the season as a whole, the setting, the rules updates, and we're going to try to make it as new player friendly as possible, because we're hoping that this season will bring an influx of new players, fresh blood to the game, and we're hoping that this episode can be a resource for you if you're one of those new players. And of course, if you are a returning player, a seasoned veteran, then you're still going to be able to hear our thoughts as you always do. So we're going to jump into things pretty quickly, and just going to start off by saying thank you so much to our patrons. You guys help us continue to create the content that we do, whether it's through our podcast, through our blog articles, and our budding YouTube channel. More on that a bit later. But really, we really, really appreciate it. Thank you to everyone who supports us. And if you are interested, you can just look us up on patreon.com/pathtoglory. That's where you can support us. But again, we're just really happy that you're listening, and we're excited to talk about the Gnarlwood. But before we do that, we're going to do a couple things, in order to start the episode as we usually do. So Zach, earlier you said that it's been a while since we chatted. So what have you been up to since the last time we spoke?
Well, we started a new league on the Discord, their online Discord that we're talking about. Got a couple games of Exiled Dead In, trying to ride them out through the end of the Harrow Deep Nether Maze season. I'm interested to see what decks I'm going to be playing when the new cards drop, and once we start using the new rules in that league. But yeah, I've been fiddling with decks, looking at the new stuff that we're going to be talking about today. It's hard for me to play a lot of games when I know there's a big change coming, but so I've been playing a lot of Kill Team. I actually went to the Chicago Open for Kill Team. Brought my Gellerpox, got 6th place, so not bad for my first major.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. But yeah, got some painting done, got some primer done on my Gore Chosen, hoping to paint those up pretty soon to match the rest of my Khorne teams. Just doing a little bit of hobby here and there. How about you?
Yeah, it's been quite a couple busy weeks for me. I ended up playing in the Lone Star Games Expo for MCP.
Ooh.
Ended up getting 2nd there, so pretty exciting. We have a really good... It's in Texas, so it was in Dallas. So MCP in Dallas is a Shark Tank. But I was actually able to beat one of the guys who kind of has mentored me throughout the game. And it was really cool to finally overcome someone who plays at his caliber, really. And it wasn't like it was a blowout or anything. Like, it came down to, can he flip this secure? And if he can't, I win. If he does, then we go to the next round, which he most likely wins. So it was a very tough and tight game, and I'm really excited by my success there. But MCP is a game that I do love, but it comes nothing in comparison to how I feel about Warhammer Underworlds. And so I've read the rule book 5 times now. from start to finish. I truly enjoy some of the lore bits that we'll talk about in the Gnarlwood. And yeah, I've just been building stuff, painting stuff, and I'm actually working on some bases. So for those of you unfamiliar, all the Warhammer Underworlds miniatures come with pre-molded bases. So they're very thematic, and they don't necessarily have a cohesion across all the warbands. It's more so very thematic for the particular warband. So, you know, if you're playing with, you know, an undead warband, there's probably going to be skulls and bones and whatever. And then if you're playing with a warband that hangs out in the jungle, there might be plants, snakes crawling on the bases, etc. But because of the setting of the Gnarlwood, I've actually watched a lot of hobbying videos, and I'm going to be building on top of the bases to where I can, you know, already utilize what's on the bases themselves, but give it more of like they're actually in the woods or a jungle. You know, even though it's called the Gnarlwood, it's pretty much like a jungle. So I'm really excited to share that progress, and I will in the Discord, on our blog. I'll talk about it, of course, here, and then maybe on YouTube as well, if I can figure out the proper settings for my camera. But that's really kind of what I've been up to. I was in New York all week, so we've kind of had to delay some of the recording for work. But I really enjoyed New York. And then I'm going overseas in like 3 days to my cousin's wedding. So I'll be gone for over 10 days, which is really exciting. But that means that I'll be out of town, out of the country, really, when all the Gnarlwood updates go live. So I'm going to have to really make sure I get that timing down to where I can post at the correct time. So
yeah, I got to feed that algorithm, huh?
Well, I, you know, there's an embargo date, so I'm just going to have to do some time zone foo here. And then make sure that it goes live so everybody can view our content.
I'm sure everyone'll be excited. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, glad that we caught up and we've both been really busy. Congrats again on
you too.
You know, top 8 at Kill Team. That's really exciting. And let's jump into the Gnarlwood. So on our last episode, we kind of really shared our enthusiasm and our hype for this setting. Mm-hmm. But if you haven't listened to that last episode, that's okay, because we're really just going to talk about this whole thing from start to finish. So I have my rule book in front of me. I already have it spiral bound, which is very exciting. Ooh. But the reason I have it spiral bound is because I actually ripped it apart to scan it so I could send it to Zach.
And I appreciate that, because I don't get those review copies yet. So,
well, you do, because we are...
Well, as part of the group, yes.
Yeah. So... I try, but yeah, I'm really glad that it's bound and you can't really see the edges torn off anymore. So
yeah,
here we are. So let's talk about the setting, right? So Warhammer Underworlds is starting a new season. So what that means for those of you who may not be familiar is we're going to have a rotation that Zach alluded to earlier. That means the Dire Chasm season, which is the fourth season of Warhammer Underworlds, will be rotating. What does that mean? All the universal cards in that season are no longer eligible in championship play. And there's also Nemesis format, which we'll talk about in a little bit, as well as the Rivals format. And they won't be eligible to play in those formats either. But they can be played in Relic format, which is, you know, the Legacy/Base format of the game, if you will. And so all the Warband cards, so for example, like if you like Starblood Stalkers, which is the Lizardmen Warband, very popular, or the Crimson Court, which is 4 vampires, then you can still play with the faction cards, the Warband cards, and that's denoted by symbols on the cards themselves, which you'll be able to identify pretty easily. So with that, there's going to be a huge shakeup with the way the game is played and how it's marketed and released. And so in Nethermaze and in Harrowdeep, which are the two previous seasons, 6-month seasons, we were in the Realm of Shadow and Ulgu, and Dire Chasm was in the Realm of Beasts. And it looks like for the Gnarlwood, we're back in the Realm of Beasts. And so there's been a little bit of back and forth online about, oh, we're back in the Realm of Beasts, etc. I personally find it very exciting. But Zach, I wanted to get your thoughts on how you feel about being back in Gur, if you will, the Realm of Beasts.
Oh, I'm happy about it, man. From what I understand, they kind of want to tie it a little bit more together with the greater overall Age of Sigmar narrative, so Underworlds doesn't really feel like its own thing. During the first season, it was like that, because at the time, AOS 2 had just dropped, we had just gotten Soul Wars and Sacrosanct Chamber, and Death was kind of the big bad guy, and we were in... the
Shadespire?
City. Shadespire. It was Shade something. I was like blanked out. And Shadespire was like brought up in some of the lore books in AOS. So there like was overlap. And then we kind of lost that a little bit. But now we're kind of bringing it back together because the big part of the AOS narrative right now is in Gur. So I'm really excited to kind of see them bring that back together. Age of Sigmar doesn't feel like its own little thing off in the corner anymore. It kind of feels like we're part of the greater team now, which is very cool. As somebody who likes Warcry and Age of Sigmar, I'm all for it. And I like Gur as well. I mean, it's a cool setting. You got beasts, you got living trees that try to eat you. You got swamps made of monsters that like have dudes living in them that harvest poison from the environment. Like it's a really cool setting, and I think the teams that are involved in this box and the lore that they have that kind of wrap into the Gnarlwood as a location, they're both really, really cool. So I'm excited to see what the next two teams are for this and then whatever comes after that.
I echo and share your enthusiasm greatly. I mean, you know, talking about that cohesive push for the Age of Sigmar narrative, right? You know, we have Age of Sigmar box set, which was the new Stormcast versus the Swamp Orcs. And that was in Thondia, right? Like Thondia gets thrown around a lot, which is like, I guess, a continent-sized battle sphere on or in the Realm of Beast, which is Gur. And the Gnarlwood has been referenced in Warcry as well. You know, you alluded to the poison people and stuff. Like, bunch of warbands running around a bunch of woods in a very dangerous area. The Realm of Beast is where everything is hunter or quarry, if you will, right? Like you are either prey or predator, sometimes both. So it's very exciting to see that. And it actually says very quickly in the book, the Gnarlwood, it's in Western Thondia, which is a direct reference to Age of Sigmar. And it says it's an ancient and savage forest. I think it's more of a jungle, but it says forest where even the trees crave the taste of raw flesh. Deep beneath its twisted canopy lies another world entirely, a misty underworld of roots and knotted boughs where ancient secrets lie half buried in the soil.
It's just really cool, man. I mean, trees that eat people, it's very cool. These halls hewn out of, or grown in some cases, out of these trees. It just like elicits this really visceral image that I think, you know, people give Age of Sigmar a lot of grief for not being Warhammer Fantasy, and Warhammer Fantasy was great, but as a setting, just like the weirdness and like the craziness that it brings in its realms and its cities and its factions is just, I love it. I think it's so cool what they're doing with the setting.
It's so Warhammer, which I love. It's just like the most dangerous, grotesque environments where like you have a 99.9% chance of just certain death.
Yes.
Right. Which is great. And it's really cool because Warcry is fought like on the top levels of the Gnarlwood, right? But as you know, as that paragraph I read earlier alludes to, and as if you read through the book and the lore at the beginning of the rule book, there are carnivorous caverns and environments and like ancient root systems underneath the Gnarlwood. And that's kind of where our game is set, right? In the underworld of the Gnarlwood, right?
You're right.
Is a very exciting, very cool experience where there's, you know, these roots that might snare you and capture you. You know, there are, as I mentioned, half-buried treasures, which is very common, right? You know, you find random weapons in these areas, like any proper adventure game. And in the past, it's like, you know, who are the silent people? Who are the cataphranes, things like that. So I really like how they have their own lore and stuff.
Yeah.
And really one of the lines in the Gnarlwood is so great. It's menagerie of murderous denizens is driven by single-minded need to devour raw flesh and encompasses every conceivable nightmare. So cool.
It's almost like Dark Souls-esque, like, you go into this forest and you go down into the roots and then you like find a hall or like a, you know, a throne room carved out of a tree and there's things there that are trying to eat you. It's like, it's so cool. It's so like wacky, insane fantasy.
Yeah. It's amazing. And like a lot of the artwork and some of the objectives, like they demonstrate like scattered relics of the Seraphon, you know, and their mysterious masters, the old ones. And it's really cool because Jesku just got announced on Warcom, who's fighting in Thondia.
Yeah.
Lizards.
And the Seraphon are like, you know, they like live between the realms in spaceships. It's very weird, but like they do have this huge presence on Gur. So I don't know if we'll see a Seraphon team, but like to see their like remains and see their like ruins that we're, you know, fighting over and through is it like really binds that lore together, you know. It's good.
Yeah. It's good. So I just love how, as you mentioned, there is an all-encompassing story that happens for the Age of Sigmar. The spotlight is on the realm of Gur, specifically Thondia. And then for the skirmish games, it's in the Gnarlwood, right? Above, or actually on the floors of the Gnarlwood, and then in the root halls underneath the Gnarlwood, which is just as deadly, honestly, as the forest floor above. So
yeah,
super exciting. I think there's a lot of cool things to talk about. And what's really cool is it actually talks about Beastgrave in the rulebook as well. There's a section on page 8 that talks about the doom of Beastgrave. So if you're interested in talking about what, you know, what happened, because Beastgrave and Direchasm are in the realm of Gur, right? So they're there. And so I really like how they took the time to talk about what happened, right? And if you are, spoilers, interested in learning, essentially, the Beastgrave is destroyed. It lies in ruins. No longer does the Predator Mountain project an aura of frenzied ferocity that infect all who pass beneath it. Instead, the entrances have been sealed beneath tons of stone. And it even says many of the warbands who once prowled the tunnels and caverns of the Beastgrave were slain. So, you know, in your own headcanon or in your league's lore, whichever warbands died, right? Like, there's no more Curse of the Cataphrane. So what's really cool is, as players, we're taking control of the narrative now to see who survives the Gnarlwood, which is really exciting.
Yeah, and it's gonna be fun to see that vary from group to group. You know, like some people, you know, you can have your own personal headcanon. Like, I played Rippas all through Beastgrave and Direchasm, but then I retired them on the shelf, and in my mind, they died in those halls, and now I'm playing whichever one survived into, you know, through Ulgu into the Gnarlwood now. It's cool. It gives a lot of, you know, flexibility and like narrative purpose to your players, which I think is great.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's going to appeal to any skirmish player, whether it's Underworld side or Warcry side, maybe even Kill Team, right? Like you're kind of doing both sides of the universes there. So
right.
Super excited. But that's enough about lore. I mean, I think, you know, if you want to dig deeper and talk about it more, I certainly urge you to read the first couple pages of the books. There's some really cool excerpts as well on the Null Spirit Pack and the Sons of Velmorn, which are the two warbands that come in this box set. Mm-hmm. Now, we're not going to go into the details of them specifically right now. I mean, we'll talk about like the high level stuff, but we're going to have dedicated episodes for those warbands coming up. They should be already live when you see this one as well. But what's really exciting, Zach, and this is something that we talked about last time, is that this is the first time where we don't have a Grand Alliance Order warband in the starter set. How do you feel about that? Are you excited?
Yeah, well, one, I'm glad it's not another Stormcast warband. Like, I love Stormcast. I have two whole detolfs full of Stormcast over there. I think it's a really cool faction in general, but we're pushing 5-6 Stormcast teams. We didn't need another one, and we had just gotten Hexbanes to kind of cover your, you know, mortal humans,
right?
And we've got it recently had a bunch of elf teams, so I'm kind of okay with there not being an order one. I think it's nice that we're kind of looking at other ones, and, you know, kind of connecting back to Warcry, the Gnarl Spirit Pack in particular gives us this view of humans in the mortal realms that are not part of Grand Alliance Order, that are part of Chaos, but not like, you know, dedicated to a Chaos God. It's like humans that have gone feral in this situation, gone feral, or have worshipped in other ways Chaos as a spirit, which is what the Warcry war bands are all about. And now we're kind of seeing that, not in the same manner, but in a very similar manner in Underworlds. And Sons of Elmorn, I mean, I love death stuff. I ranted last time about how much Grand Alliance death is the coolest, and these models are absolutely sick. I think Velmorn is like one of the coolest White Kings ever made. Yeah, I mean, this is it's a little, you know, I'm happy that it's not just good guys versus monsters or good guys versus bad guys. Now we're kind of get these bad guy versus bad guy, or like, you know, morally gray characters versus bad guys. And I think it's going to be, it gives, again, a little bit of cool narrative license to your players to not have to be, one player's not forced into being the good guy if you're splitting the box and you care about that sort of thing.
Yeah, but I also think that, you know, you use the phrase good guy and bad guy a lot, and not to be not to push back too much on that, but really, if you want to think about it, like, good and bad depends on your perspective in all Warhammer stuff, period.
Of
right?
course, yeah.
You know, like, in some cases, if you've read, like, Nagash's story, he can be justified.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and, you know, they've left it very gray, and even, like,
Sigmar, you know, he's kind of a not, you know, not, well, I'm not going to say the word, I almost did.
No,
but
He's kind of a dictator. He's authoritarian, yes.
Yeah.
But even, like, one of the things I really like about Warcry, not to get too off topic from Underworlds, it shows how you have these clans and these factions that, like, they're not, like, you know, blood sacrifice worshipping the Chaos Gods. You know, they're like, we're smiths and we worship this volcano because it gives us, you know, the lava and the heat that we need to, like, forge our weapons. And they just happen to worship Khorne because they, like, you know, do gladiator combat and do honorable combat, which Khorne loves, and they give him skulls and stuff. And it's like, it's interesting to see these factions that aren't, like, it's not your traditional bad guys where they're just, like, you know, stomping on people and, like, ravaging lands, but, like, you can see how a mortal person in the mortal realms who's cut off from, like, Sigmar and the cities of Sigmar might fall to chaos and not be, like, a slavering insane person. So it's it's cool. It really expands the universe to me.
Yeah, like, I mean, if you really want to, like, even for these two warbands, right, like, these are just humans who grew up far from civilization, and they just kind of adopted whatever they were taught or they came across, and these are their cultures and their traditions, and to them it's their way of life, and they probably believe that they're living the best life possible, until some, you know, person who may not understand their culture is like, oh, you're worshiping chaos, you know. So it's, like, really cool on that front. But even with the Death Warband, right, like, you know, even good intentions can lead you down the path of damnation. And in this case, like, King Velmorn was just trying to protect his kingdom, puts on this crown because he thinks it's going to give him power. And he does defend his kingdom, but what he doesn't realize, which is a consequence, is that him and his sons are forever cursed to live forever. Right.
Yeah.
And it's like, they both are right and they're both wrong.
Yeah. And I mean, that's like a very standard trope for, like, undead factions and, you know, things like wights and skeletons and liches and vampires, you know, trading your soul for power, trading your soul for protection. And it's cool to see it represented here. I think this faction is going to be really interesting narratively. Like, it, you know, we're kind of, you know, salivating over it here. But if you really are interested in the lore and the story of Age of Sigmar, like, reading the narrative in this rule book is going to give you a good stepping stone into that setting. And then usually there's, you know, books that will tie into the setting in some fashion or some capacity, or short stories or something. So you can go dig up the old Underworlds ones, or dig up, you know, rule books for Warcry or Age of Sigmar that are going to have all this stuff in there as well. So, yeah, I mean, it's a great stepping stone for anyone who's trying to get into the lore of the game and might not know a lot about it.
Exactly. Yeah, well said. So enough oogling on these two warbands. I think, you know, overall, they're going to be really exciting, and I think you're really going to enjoy listening to how they play, because they're very interesting warbands, and then, of course, our thoughts on them. So we're just going to keep trudging along here. One of the things aesthetically that changed with this season is the way, I think every season has a little bit of, like, different stylization on the rim of the cards. And so the fighter cards and the universal cards and the faction cards have, like, this kind of grayish thing on them that's, like, the roots of the, you know, Gnarlwood. So that's something new and can help you differentiate between seasons. But what I really liked is that they've just put the logos everywhere. Yes. So there's, like, no confusion on what's what, which is, I think, is very great for any player, new or existing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we'll talk about the Rivals decks in a future episode. But to that end, they do kind of now separate differentiate the rivals decks by themselves rather than being the full set. And I think that'll be nice for new players who are like, hey, where's this card from? You can just look at the logo and see where it is. Or like, you know, when maybe you've got your collection all kind of spread out in front of you. I usually end up with like 15 different piles of cards on my table once I start building a deck. And you're like, hey, oh man, what rivals deck did this go to? Where did this come from? And now it's going to be really easy for you to get things organized and make sure that you've got all your ducks in a row, so to speak.
Yeah, and it's super cool because every rivals deck, and for those of you not familiar, a rivals deck is a pre-constructed deck that either is for your warband or for a universal selection, so that can work with any warband. And on the back of all the title cards for the decks, it has a list of every card as well. Mm-hmm. So not only are they numbered 1 through 32 for their specific logo, but if you ever want to just get all the names, you know, there's so many ways in which you can put them all together. But let's talk about the contents very quickly. We've got the two warband miniatures, a four-man warband and a five-man warband, the Gnarl Spirit pack fighter cards and rivals deck, the Sons of Velmorn fighter cards and rivals deck, the Tooth and Claw rivals deck, the Daring Delvers rivals deck, a bunch of tokens and counters, two double-sided boards. I mean, that's really it. I mean, it's pretty packed with stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good amount for the box, and these core boxes are always really good, and this one's no exception.
Yeah, I think this might even have more stuff than per use in terms of the number of tokens and stuff. So,
yeah.
Let's just start going through things. So traits, nothing's really changed here. I mean, traits is beast, flying, leader, wizard. So these are essentially global rules that if a fighter has one of these symbols on their cards, then it follows a particular rule that's outlined in here in the glossary.
Hmm. I think these are all the same from the previous season. Mm-hmm. None of the rules on these have changed. So if you're familiar, then you'll know what these do. Otherwise, you can read the quick blurb. It's pretty straightforward.
Yeah. Now there are also two additional rules that they're not necessarily traits, but they work similar to traits. So large, of course, is a rule that was changed in the Nethermaze that continues on in this season. Essentially, if a fighter has a wounds characteristic of five or more, including all modifiers, when they die, they give up two bounty. But additionally, if a fighter becomes large during a battle, you have to break each of their upgrades that cannot be given to a large fighter. So what that means is that break means they're just removed and discarded.
Yeah, and the same if you become a beast during the game, which there's a couple cards that do it for you. There's a couple upgrades that do it for you. In this, I think there was some confusion about this previously. Like, if you gain a trait that is no longer part of a restriction, or it means you would be bumped out of a restriction for a card, there was some confusion about whether you could still use those upgrades or whether they were already on you or not. Whether that was a thing that you could do. This just kind of makes it very black and white that no, once you no longer meet the restrictions for an upgrade, it's gone.
Yeah.
And I like that.
And it might need an FAQ in terms of like how far that goes, right? Mm-hmm. I think it's very clear, as you say, for beast and large, but like technically for hunter and quarry stuff, which I guess it's not going to exist moving forward. So maybe we don't have to worry about that.
There's a couple for factions, so maybe we will see an FAQ for those factions. Yeah. But yeah, you're right. I'm sure there's some edge cases, but I think the intention here has become a little bit more clear.
Yep. Agreed. So moving on, I think deck building stays the same. So for you who are may or not be familiar, your power deck, which is a combination of ploy, gambits, and upgrades, have to have at least 20, 10, and 10. You can't have more gambits than upgrades, but you can have more upgrades than gambits. And your objective card deck include at least 12 cards, but you can have more if you want, but you cannot have more than 6 surge objectives, which are objectives that can be scored during the action phase rather than at the end of the phase, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I think I love how it says, you know, everything needs to be unique. It talks about grand alliances as well. And those are pretty straightforward, right?
Yes.
All the fighter cards have those symbols, so you know whether they're order, chaos, death, or destruction.
Yeah, and for older factions that don't have those symbols, you can find them online. GW did a big update with keywords and grand alliances and stuff.
Exactly. So that being said, I think that overall covers most of the basics. Mm-hmm. There are some things that are spoken about on how to play the game and how to place fighters, But, you know, that's pretty straightforward. And if you read the rule book, you'll figure it out pretty quickly. And if obviously if you're a returning player, then, you know, it is what it is. So one of the things that I really liked is that they changed the color of the dice.
Yeah, it's nice. So in the past, for those of you listening, every core box came with white attack dice, black defense dice, and usually blue or some shade of blue magic dice. I think Nether Maze and Herodium may have had
they were different.
Dice. Yeah, they were slightly
purple
different.
Purple and blue and dark blue and stuff.
Yeah, it kind of matched the settings, but now we've got orange and green and like this reddish blood brown. It's nice to see them match the theme of the setting with the accoutrement that comes with your set, right?
Exactly. And what I really like is that these colors aren't like mixed colors or anything. Like it's going to be very clear when these dice are rolled. Like, you know, that orange is yellow and black. Those contrast very well. Green and white is a quite stark difference, as well as brown and white. So I think they're going to be visible from quite far
space.
Away. Yeah. Yeah. So I guess we'll start with, you know, placing objectives on the board, because I think that's one of the biggest changes here. And so, Zach, I like how you told me, you know, out of the darkness and into the objectives. Why don't you talk about what this change means? What it is first and what it means for the game.
Yeah, so feature token setup is still very similar to how it was in Harrowdeep and Nether Maze. You can't place on edge hexes as before, even the last one, or only the last one if you can't otherwise place it. So in terms of like how things are going to be positioned on the board, it's going to be very similar if you're already familiar with the game. But now, as soon as you finish setting up objectives, you flip them all over so they are objective side up. This is something that was kind of a big difference in Herodeep and Nether Maze, that things would start face down. There's a bit of a guessing game as to which numbers were where. But we're kind of going back to the way it was. And that's great for some factions. That's great for some play styles and objective types. But I think it's just good in overall, because I think having things face down added some complications that were probably not intended. And I think this is just going back to the basics of what we know works. The other big thing about feature token setup is that you don't set up additional feature tokens. In Beast Grave and Dire Chasm, we set up lethal tokens. In Herodeep and Nether Maze, we set up cover tokens. Now, there are other additional feature tokens, which are cover or snare tokens, depending on the side that's up, but they don't go up during setup. There will be ways to place them down the line that we'll probably talk about in a different podcast, but they don't go up during setup. So the only thing that's going to be on the board, other than your fighters, is just objective tokens, which are objective side up. And that's a pretty big change from what we've been playing for the past, you know, 6 months to a year. Amon, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an incredible change. And I think one of the ways that I view Gnarlwood specifically, which I probably should have said earlier, is that it almost feels like a soft reboot to Warhammer Underworlds. I think there are a lot of clarifications made in this rulebook. I think there are a lot of additional rules that take away from things that players have, complained about in the past. And it streamlines a lot of stuff, which we're going to talk about today. But, you know, if you fell in love with Shadespire and Nightbolt, or you joined the game in Beastgrave and Dire Chasm, like, we're going back to the way we used to play the game, which I think is super exciting. Now you know where all the objectives are. And that's really it. There's no additional feature tokens. And feature tokens are essentially referred to any token that, I guess, is a feature, whether it's an objective, a cover, or a snare, right?
Yes.
And so the back of the objectives still have cover hexes, which I think is still great. A cover hex is essentially, if you're in it, you can count double-sided supports as successes on defense because it's providing you some sort of cover. But what I really like is that we're not placing these additional tokens, so setup is faster and it's more streamlined so that we can focus on getting to playing the game, which is fun. Now, this does mean that cards that relied on cover may not be as reliable, but it's still possible, which is important, right? Because you can still delve. And we're going to talk about that delve change in a moment, but I'm really excited for the fact that, you know, cover still exists, objectives still exist, but we're just objective face up. Now, go ahead. What do you have to say?
I was going
to
say, there's also some cards that some objectives or power cards in the past that also, you know, they played off feature tokens in general. Things like Fearless Seekers, where it's just beyond two feature tokens in enemy territory. Those were very easy to set up because you could just set up an objective and a cover right next to each other. And those objectives will change in value. And like you said, they're not going to go away in value. They're not going to become terrible because there's still five tokens on the board and there's ways to place more tokens. So I wouldn't, before you go crazy about like, oh, this change is going to kill certain decks, certain cards, you can still play them. They still will be usable, but they may require a different approach to use.
Yeah. I mean, again, I think the important thing is they're all playable and there are plenty of cards, new cards especially, that can help you maintain those older play styles if that's what you're interested in, but also certainly explore newer ways to play the game in terms of mechanics and stuff.
Yep.
Now, one of the cool things about how we delve. So for those of you unfamiliar, delving is when you can you stand on a feature token, you can flip it to the other side. Now in the past, delving kind of was scot-free. Every fighter could delve whenever they were eligible to delve, and only an objective could be delved once per power phase. But now a huge change is when you delve, you actually become staggered when you delve. So that means that if you're flipping, let's say, a cover side to an objective or vice versa, you know, cover will give you a defensive boost, but it also kind of like almost cancels it out because your opponent gets that reroll because you are now staggered. And I think you mentioned, you know, in the notes that rerolls are generally better or more powerful than double support successes. And on top of that, the stagger mechanic is more important now. And I really believe it's because like you're fighting in like this root system. So, you know, like the roots that are actively trying to consume raw flesh are kind of impeding you from fighting and stuff and ensnaring you, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But if you are staggered already, you can't actually make the delve action. Yes. So what do you think about that, Zach? Because I think that's a huge change.
Yeah, that it is a massive change just because now it effectively means for most situations, a fighter can only delve once a turn because you'll get a stagger token, you'll become staggered, and unless you guard to get rid of it or have some other way to remove stagger tokens, you can't delve again. I think there was an article that showed like the first half of this change. It said you stagger when you delve, but it didn't talk about that second part where you can't re-delve once you have been staggered. It means that delving is going to be very... It's something that you're going to just think about now, because currently in the game, a lot of what happens is you go onto a feature token, you try to have it as a cover during your opponent's turn so you get defensive bonus, and then you try to make it a objective during your turn so you can score things off of it or inspire off it for certain factions, or have an objective at the end of the game. And it's just kind of like you're just flipping these back and forth kind of willy-nilly to score things, to get bonuses, to do things that you want with it. Now you really got to think about delving. And in some ways that's good, in some ways that's bad. It's a change and it's a new way to think about it. And I think that's really good for the game because now it's not just, hey, I've got three dice on dodge and I'm standing on a cover token, I'm basically invincible. Now it's like, ooh, do I want to delve? What does your attack profile look like? Because a reroll, if your opponent's just two dice on hammers, that reroll's still pretty good. For stagger, giving your opponent the reroll is still pretty good, but it's not as damaging as it is like three dice on hammers. You know, like attack and defense profiles are going to make stagger versus cover a really big question. And what you get out of that cover is a big question. If you have cards that boost you out of cover, if your faction like Shadeborn that gets a lot from cover hexes, it might be worth taking that stagger. So I think it's a change that really will benefit smart players that think about the game state and think about their next couple turns, because you can't just delve on first action and, you know, delve back later. It's just, you know, you can't really do that anymore. So it's going to change the face of the game in such a big way from what we have right now.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, I think, you know, it's interesting because like this was a part of the feedback that players felt like was a little gimmicky or maybe a little like cumbersome.
Mm-hmm.
And now effectively a player is now almost disincentivized to delve, but there are going to be a lot of niche situations where delving is the best thing to do. And there are going to be cards and strategies that support that. But now you no longer have the frustration of like, oh, it's so hard to hit my opponent in a cover hex, right? Because now you get that extra reroll, which means you get an extra chance of rolling a critical success, which means that attack can go through. And I think that was one of my biggest challenges with, the previous season was sometimes it just felt like I couldn't hit anything unless I rolled a crit. And now it gives me that opportunity.
And if you are the sort of player who likes cover hexes, there are still printed cover hexes. There's a bunch in Nether Maze and Harrowdeep. I think there's a printed hex on every board in this season as well, at least one. And there are ways, and you only get the stagger token if you do the delve action. So if you have a card that flips a token or some mechanic that flips tokens that's not a delve action, you can still claim this cover hex, but you have to be a little bit smarter about it, which I think is great. I think that's good for the game.
Yep, I completely agree. I think it's a great change, and I'm really excited because when and if we see it, it's going to be more meaningful.
Mm-hmm.
And a boon to both players, and a con as well.
So, yeah, pluses and minuses, but I think overall healthier for the game.
Yeah, and I think we're going to see this dagger mechanic be in use more often, which, you know, it was introduced in the last two seasons, and it's a great mechanic, but we didn't see it as much as I think we will now, which is fun.
Yeah, it was really just for the most part, it was just Exile Dead and Skittershank's Clawpack taking advantage of it, and not really in many other places.
Yep. So let's keep trudging along then and talk about even more rules changes.
Yes.
So I think this is going to be a really huge one to the way the game is played. And essentially, it's the way fighters move. So Zach, do you want to highlight this rule?
Yeah. So this is a big one. And I've seen, I can see pluses and minuses to it from the way the game is played right now. But I think ultimately it just means the game is going to be played a little differently, like the delve change. So basically before, when you had a move token, you couldn't move or charge again. Your fighter was done making a move for that turn unless you had some power card that let you do another one. Now you can always move if you have another move if you have a move token on you. You can just make a second or third or fourth move, but you still can't charge. It's pretty big for some factions.
Huge, yeah.
Yeah, but ultimately it's still kind of hard to judge the impact of it, because at the end of the day, you don't want to be spending two activations moving the same fighter. Like, in certain situations, that would be really powerful if you need to get to a specific location, if you need to keep a fighter safe, et cetera, et cetera. But you only get four activations in a turn. If you're using two of them to move, you're not dealing damage. You're not necessarily scoring off it. You might be, but probably not if it's the same fighter moving twice. That's not amazing action economy, but there will be certain situations where you're like, actually, I could use the chance to move this guy again. And I think that's going to, there will be edge cases where it's a game changing change of the game, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, but it also just makes sense. Like, why couldn't fighters just move multiple times, right? And, and you know, like, purists of the game will say, you know, or perhaps not even purists, but veteran players will say, like, you know, that was kind of the fun aspects of it, was like, while it may necessarily not mean to make sense, like, it's a great version of the way the game is played, is that once the fighters move, they can't move again. But I think this opens up so many tactical opportunities, because oftentimes, you know, if a fighter moved and then you displace them for whatever reason, then that was it. They can't move again.
Right.
You know, and the whole like idea was that this is all happening in seconds. So like, you know, each round is seconds, because, you know, fighting is fast, brutal, and sometimes concise. And right. So in this situation, like, as you mentioned, there are like, there's an opportunity cost perhaps for moving again, but at the same time, now you'll have to think about, well, this fighter is no longer Like, sometimes you could just ignore a fighter. Like, they've moved, I've displaced them, or I haven't. I don't have to worry about them anymore. But now, you know, you bump a fighter off an objective, they can just move back on if they want to. And right. So you have to kind of plan out a little bit more with your cards and your strategies and what your opponent can or cannot do. And so while it's a great intuitive change for the new player, for a veteran player, it actually almost completely enhances the way that we've been playing the game, because we've never dealt with this before. So it just opens up so many different tactical possibilities.
Yeah, and I've seen some people say that, like, oh, you know, it's, you're removing the downside of moving, which is that you're locked in place. And I think you're just, you are removing that downside, but you, it's just a new downside, right? It's, you still can't charge. You still can't do certain things that require you to not have a move token. There's still a downside to moving as opposed to doing other things. It's opportunity cost. Whereas before it was more severe, I think there's the opportunity cost in moving, because I think if you're an aggro team, you want to do four charges, right? Like, the ability now to move multiple times is not really going to change that. Hold objective teams are just going to have to play differently, and you're going to have to play differently into them, knowing that they, like you said, if you push them off the objective, they can move back on. It will change the game, but I don't think it's necessarily a negative in any way, shape, or form. Maybe I'm just being overly positive about it, but that's how I feel.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great change. I'm very positive on it too.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's going to open up so much tactical, like, opportunity and like, allow you to really engage the think tank, if you will, to where it's going to be a better change for everyone. Because, again, if you're new, then you're going to learn to play the game this way. But if you're an older player, you kind of have to relearn the game in some aspects, which is pretty exciting, because you want a game that continues to evolve and challenge you, right?
Yeah. And then we would be remiss to not go talk about the change that goes hand in hand with this, is how charge tokens work. So before, if you had a charge token, that fighter was done for the round, unless they had some way to clear the charge token or were Molog. Now, if all of your fighters have a charge token, which is to say, if it's your last fighter and they have a charge token, or everyone else, you've made three charges and you only have three fighters, etc., a fighter can be activated. They can't move, they can't make another charge, but they can attack or go on guard or do anything else that requires them to stand still. And which is a fairly large change. Amon, what are your feelings on this?
Yeah, so it's huge, right?
Mm-hmm.
And again, this comes back to that past experience as a player, who it's like, oh, this fighter's charged, I don't have to worry about them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they're standing next to all of my dudes or whatever, they're just frozen in time, if you will. So, and that didn't really make a lot of sense to, you know, when I try to explain the game to new players, they'd be like, well, why can't I do anything? It's like, because you've charged. And in a board game, and like in a limited format, that makes sense. But I really think oftentimes, like, one of the benefits of playing larger warbands is you have the opportunity to make the most out of your activations. And a lot of warbands in this game are 3 and 4 fighters. And so if you're already starting with less fighters than the number of total activations you can make in the game, or you lose a fighter, you know, and you drop down to that lower than 4 number, then sometimes it feels bad because you're like, well, I've already done this and I've done this and I've done this. I don't know what else to do, right? But now you can continue to activate your fighters, albeit in a limited capacity, so that you still have something to do. So maybe if you don't want to draw a card, or you want to make your fighter more survivable, you know, they took a risky charge. Maybe they took a hit and they're damaged and you're like, well, I really need to save this fighter. I'm going to go on guard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a fighter should be able to do that. Or it's like, oh, you know, they charged, they missed, I committed them. They're maybe in an unfortunate position, but maybe I can keep making attacks, you know, if my warband has already fully activated. So I really like it. I think it benefits smaller fighters, smaller warbands in terms of like fighter count. But overall, like, I think it's a great change in general, because like, there are going to be games where you play a 7-fighter warband and you lose 3-4 fighters in the first 2 rounds.
Yes.
You know, like, can you make your final round more impactful and more engaging for you and your opponent? And the same goes for any of those smaller count fighters as well in those warbands. So I'm super positive about this change. I think more attacks is always great. I love rolling dice and fighting. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, not really much more to add, really.
Yeah, I think this will, it's definitely a change that unevenly affects teams. Like you said, large teams won't really get this until you're close to tabled. You won't really get much use out of it unless you have some way to like hand out charge tokens. But, you know, like you said, in those third rounds, it can be really devastating as a team like Sepulchral Guard or Gloomspite Gits, or Zarbag's Gits, rather, where you're like, you know, you're designed to have all these fighters. And then if you have like two guys left at the end of the game, you're like, well, I can't do anything. Like, I'm going to charge with one of them. I'm just going to be SOL. And now there's kind of that feeling that maybe I can make that risky charge and then do something later. Or maybe I can, you know, double charge, try to get some damage done and then finagle my way into a better position. It does mean that there will be some weirdness with big guy teams like Morgox Crushes, like Rippas, that will gain more benefit of from this than other teams. Mm-hmm. But I think we just need to see how that plays out. I mean, it's very easy to sit here and be like, oh, this guy's falling. Crushes are just going to like triple charge and then Morgox is going to hit you again and it's going to be terrifying. But like, the realness of those situations is, I think, not extremely clear. And I think you should try out the change before you think that, you know, it's going to end on Warhammer Underworlds as we know it.
Yeah. And look, I think we are both very positive on the changes. And, mm-hmm. and while I think it is important to mention some of the feedback or reactions, sure. I don't think we stand in that category at all.
Oh, definitely not. No.
I think these are great changes for the game.
Absolutely.
These are streamlining the changes for new players as well as existing players. And honestly, a lot of this stuff people have been asking for years. And so I'm finally glad that we're getting it, you know, in year 5 and 6 of the game. So
it shows that they are listening and that they are willing to make these big shakeup changes and they're not just keeping it chugging along. They're like, hey, let's do a shakeup to the game and see how it affects everybody's play experience, which I like.
Yeah, completely agree. So the next big change that we're going to talk about is the power step. So, Zach, why don't you handle that one?
Sure, yeah. The power step currently in Harrowdeep and Nethermaze, you'll finish your activation, and then your opponent has a chance to play a power card in the power step, in your power step, that is, before you do. Now that's changing, and when it's your power step, you'll play the first power card. This is, yeah. Again, kind of a, like we talked about the objectives, it's a bit of a soft reset. This is the way it's always been up until Harrowdeep and Nethermaze. And I don't know if it was just kind of a shakeup that they were trying for a season in Ulgu, or if, you know, they kind of like got the feedback, or maybe they just wanted to shake it up and see how it played out. But I like that it's going back. It definitely changes the viability of some cards, just as the previous change did. You know, ping damage cards lose some viability when your opponent gets a chance to react before you play them. On the other hand, certain types of pushes gain viability depending on who's going first. So I think this is it's a change. It's hard to say whether it's a good change or a bad change. I think it's more intuitive to be like, I just went, it's my power step, I'm going to play the first power card. So I think that it's good in the way that it feels smoother to play. But in terms of like overall game balance, I think it's kind of neutral one way or the other.
Completely agree. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a good change. I think it was nice to play something different and mm-hmm. have to like, you know, re-engage our minds in a different way if you were an existing player. But, you know, it feels better to just go back to the way things were because it is your power phase. You should be able to benefit from it, I think. So I like it. Super simple, easy change.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Let's mm-hmm. talk about... I guess we can talk about reactions. This is going to be a pretty interesting aspect here. But do you want to talk about this one as well?
Yeah, I think this is actually like low key one of the biggest changes.
Yeah.
Previously, reaction windows, only one player could trigger them. Only one reaction card could trigger a reaction window at a time. So whether it was one player trying to do it or both, it was always the person whose turn it was not was able to use that reaction window before the opponent or before the person whose turn it is. Now both players can use the same reaction window. Both players still only get one card, but the player whose turn it is reacts first. So if I'm playing a reaction and Amon's playing a reaction and it's during my attack, like we both have a card that plays after an attack deals damage or something like that, my card will resolve and then his card will resolve. This is potentially huge. There was, you know, for those of you who are new or those of you who are like learning kind of the competitive side of things, there's this idea of blocking reaction windows where you're like, oh, I know my opponent has a really powerful effect in this reaction window. I'm going to play a reaction in that reaction window so they can't do it. And you can't do that anymore. But I think that's interesting because it now leads a new element. It makes certain reactions that would regularly get blocked now a lot more viable because you can't block them. It makes certain reactions a little bit more interesting because they might have some weird interaction with opponent reactions. Maybe like there's a ping damage reaction and now you have a heal reaction that you would use before that ping damage goes off, or like in the same window. It's low key, like I said, kind of the biggest change in the set. How do you feel about it, Amon?
You know, so there's a, at first, well, so it's a little conflicting, but I think overall positive. I'll tell you why.
Mm-hmm.
I was a big proponent of, you know, the more mistakes or misplays you are, the more you're punished in this game.
Mm-hmm.
And I think like that even stems to, you know, when we first talked about the mulligan changes that came in Harrowdeep, you know, earlier on the podcast, you know, many episodes ago. One of the benefits that I liked is that like if you built your deck a bit too greedy and you drew a bunch of bad cards, or maybe not ideal cards is a better way to phrase it, that was it. You threw them away and you had to pay the price. But ultimately, the mulligan change is a really good thing because it's more forgiving and it allows people to take risks and innovate and build better decks, right?
Mm.
Or at least decks that are not as uniform as they may usually have been. And same with this reaction thing, right? Like, I like the fact that you were able to block each other's reactions. But then I also understand that that came with a negative feel, right? Sometimes it could even be considered a negative play experience. And I really like that that has been eliminated because now you get to play your cards. You get to do your cool stuff. I get to play my cards. I get to do my cool stuff. And sure, the order matters a little bit, but you're never letting me not play my card when it's supposed to be played, which I think is super exciting. And I think one of the things that this season has done in terms of the core rules changes has removed a lot of the ways in which the game can be feel bad for an existing player, but especially a new player. You know, like try explaining to a new player, well, you can't play your card. I blocked it. You know?
Yeah.
But now it's like, oh, well, we can both play our card, but now the turn, like the sequencing matters, which is something that can be learned very easily rather than, I don't get to play my card. You know?
Yeah. And there were definitely also at table or, you know, in person feel bad moments where, you know, you, because your cards are hidden, right? Like, you would do something and then you'd be like, and then I react with this and you show the like card.
Drop card. You know, yeah. If you played Yu-Gi-Oh or whatever.
Yeah. And then your opponent goes, oh, no, you can't play that. I'm reacting. Now they know what you have in your hand. And it's really kind of your fault for not waiting for them to react in the same window. Cause it's like, oh, well, I should have known that maybe you were going to react here. I should have asked if you had a reaction to that or something like that. But now they just have information they wouldn't have otherwise. Or like maybe you showed off a card that you think you could use in a different situation. Now you can't really because your opponent knows about it. Now you're just going to slap down that reaction card and those situations are all gone. So like you said, I think this is, I think it's going to feel a lot smoother and it's going to lead to less feel bad situations.
Completely agree. I'm all for this change. And I think the rule book does a really good job of explaining what that looks like.
Mm-hmm.
Not only does page 42 explain like when reactions take place, their limits and the chains, but the advanced rules that, you know, it's like half the page is just dedicated to explaining this.
Mm.
On the following page, on page 43, there's a full diagram that actually shows you each of the reaction steps, the opportunities in which players can be able to use reactions. And, you know, there's a symbol that represents a reaction step now in the diagram, and you'll see them throughout the rule book, but it pretty much indicates like when there is a reaction step, which I think is the most defined and clear way which we've seen reactions explained ever. And, you know, I know it took us a while to get here, but it's amazing, and I'm very excited.
Yeah, and they've really embraced, like, the flowchart, which I love.
Yeah, I mean, people need it. I mean, the flowchart is super important, super relevant. So really happy with that. Now, there's another cool part of the rulebook that I've really been appreciative of as well, and these are called minor steps. Zach, you know, as talking about diagrams and stuff, do you want to talk about minor steps?
Yeah, the minor steps are, it's nothing new if you've been playing the game, but now it's just kind of defined and it's a little bit more clear. Early on in the earlier parts of the season, or earlier parts of the game during, like, I think it was during Nightfall and Beastgrave where they first really defined when these things happen. Like, after an activation, what happens first? Can I react first? Do I inspire first? Or do I score my surge cards first? Because that order does matter. And technically, they all kind of, like, they all happen immediately after an activation. So it's, like, kind of simultaneous, but it's also matters what order it is. So they, you know, they put it in the FAQ that it goes, okay, it's reaction, inspire, surge. Or I think it might have been in a different order first. And then eventually they put in the rule book, you know, that these things happen in this order after an activation step. Now they're still in that same order. They still happen after each activation step, after each power step, but they're called minor steps and they are a solidly defined thing. They're not an activation step. They're not a power step, but they are a step and they are, you know, it's important when and how they happen and in what order. These steps also happen before the first activation in a round. And this is just kind of a catch-all for things like when do Elthane Soul Raid inspire at the start of round two, or certain things like that, you know, end of round, start of round three for Morgwraith's Blade Coven, inspire at the start of it. So that just kind of is a catch-all to be like, hey, if you inspire at the start of a round, if you inspire before the first activation step, if you have a reaction that happens before the first activation step or something like that, here it is. You know, it's clearly defined. And I think anytime, even if it's not like super impactful, anytime you have a clear definition of when something happens or when it's intended to happen, I think that's just good for the game.
Completely agree. You know, so each player's turn has a bunch of minor steps. These are reaction steps, inspire steps, surge steps, as you mentioned. But they're called minor steps because neither player is going to do anything in these steps. Oftentimes they pass without comment. But the idea is, as Zach mentioned, in corner cases or unique situations, we're going to have steps in which things can happen. In the past, we lacked clarity, but now we have complete clarity, which is, again, why I'm so happy with all the changes, is because it's streamlining everything. It's improving everything. It's defining everything. So again, another great change that honestly we just needed in the rule book, you know?
Yeah. I think it's really great that we have these. Like I said, I think anytime you have something hardly defined, whatever you want to call it, I think it's just good for the game and it future proofs. So I'm all for that.
Yeah. Now, speaking of reaction steps, you know, we mentioned that a couple times now. There is a brand new reaction step in the game. It is a universal reaction, which means any fighter can use this reaction, and it's called Plunder. And so it states this reaction. Use this during a friendly fighter's attack action that takes the target out of action. After the out of action check, place one available feature tokens in the hex the target was in, with the objective token face up. Zach, what do you think about Plunder?
This is just it's just a net positive for the game. It's not something that's going to come up in many or even most games, I would think, because there's not a huge amount of ways to remove tokens from the board. A lot of times it's either flip or something like that. But there are factions that remove from the board. There are things like Krothgorn's Man Trappers can do that. Some of the older teams can do it. And, you know, it could occasionally really mess you out of scoring if you're a hold objective team. And it's just nice to have this. And it kind of incentivizes those hold objective teams to not just sit back and hold objectives. Now you do want to kill somebody so you can plunder in case they destroy an objective or they remove one from the board or something like that. So it's a nice little addition to the game.
Yep, I completely agree. I'm all for it. Oftentimes there seem to be some negative reactions or experiences in which warbands can remove feature tokens from the board. And it was just like, man, I just can't do my game plan anymore. Or that's really frustrating for XYZ reasons. And again, I'm going to have to keep stating this because I think it's so true. Mm-hmm. They're removing a lot of the ways in which negative experiences turn people off from the game or from a particular match or from a particular play style. And now there is a way to overcome everything so that you can keep doing what you want to do. You just got to kill people, which honestly, that encourages combat, which is the whole point of playing a fast-paced skirmish game, right? So I really like it. I'm particularly excited. I think it's a great addition to the game, a universal reaction, and one that can reward players, but also reward their opponents as well, you know, should things be disappearing from the board or being added.
Yeah. And this does appear to only allow you to place objective tokens on the board, not any of the other types of feature tokens. Whether that's intended or not, I think it is intended.
It's 100% intended.
Okay, because there are other ways to add the other feature tokens via cards that we could talk about in a different podcast. So
yeah.
So, but yeah, like I said, it's just nice. And it also gives you a little bit of fun to dictate where these objectives can be. You know, if you can push an enemy into an edge hex and then go and kill them, now there's a feature token on edge hex where it couldn't be before, or like in a position where you otherwise wouldn't be able to place it, which might be advantageous to you. So that is it is there's some fun little bits to this that you might not think about.
Yeah, and just to clarify on your comment, Zach, the only way to place a snare hex would be through cards. And so there's only one deck right now that's been released thus far mm-hmm. that comes in the starter set called Daring Delvers. And there are cards in there that can place snare hexes,
right.
Which is pretty exciting, which we'll talk about that another episode.
Talk about it later, yeah.
Yeah, but for those of you who want to know what a snare hex is, which is something that we probably should have mentioned earlier, was that a snare hex token is a token that has a snare hex on one side and a cover hex on the other. So what is a snare hex? So when a fighter moves onto, is pushed onto, or is placed on a snare hex, or when a feature token in the same hex as a fighter becomes a snare hex, stagger that fighter. A fighter that is in a snare hex can remain in it without gaining further stagger tokens and can move out of it or be pushed out of it without getting further stagger tokens.
Hmm.
So makes sense.
Yeah, and it's cool. We have a new hex type. They've kind of slowly added these over time. First, blocked in the first season, and then lethals, and then now cover, and now this. So yeah, it's cool to see.
Yeah, I'm a big fan. I like it. And the last thing I really want to talk about is that now Grievous can stack. So what does that mean? Well, Grievous pretty much means that when a fighter rolls a critical success, they can add +1 damage to their attack. But now, often you'll see that fighters are labeled as Grievous 1. So that means they get +1 damage when you roll a critical success. But because now Grievous can stack similar to Knockback, if you have two cards that provide Grievous, then you can become Grievous 2. So that means when you roll a crit, you are now dealing 2 more additional damage than what your base attack was. And I think the antics here are going to be wild because I definitely think they're going to be people who are going to be like stacking Grievous as much as they can to be dealing a bunch of damage, which is super exciting. But I think it's just more streamlining of a rule while making things more deadly, which is, again, what you want, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know how often it's going to come up. I mean, it is a very cool change, you know, in theory, you're like, oh man, I can get like +3, +4 damage on a crit and just absolutely nuke anything. It does. I mean, other than fighters that have Grievous baseline on their attack, which you have people like Manok that have it, or you know, any there's a number of fighters with Grievous nowadays. But unless you have Grievous on attack, you are looking at like two or more power cards to get to Grievous more than one. But when it does happen, it's going to feel real cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's going to be super exciting. Again, I like it, and I'm looking forward to the ranged attack shenanigans that could or could not happen with this. So overall, I think these are some fantastic changes to the Gnarlwood season of Warhammer Underworlds. And again, I think this is like a great streamline slash soft reboot slash remove all the negative experiences that players have had. Games Workshop says we're listening to you, we're implementing those changes, and we want the game to be fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
So before we get into the boards, I kind of wanted to get your thoughts, Zach, on like, what do you think these changes mean for some of the more competitive strategies that we're seeing, right? You know, like we love talking about competitive stuff. Do you think we're going to see certain warbands rise to the top? Do we think we're going to see certain warbands go down to the bottom? What are your thoughts?
The biggest ones that are going to be affected just because of the cover changes are, first of all, Shadeborn. They do a lot of stuff with cover hexes. I think they're still going to be viable. There's still a lot of cover hexes on the board. They could still teleport to edge hexes. I mean, they're still good stats in general. You know, a relatively easy Inspire condition, good pink cards. Like, they're good. They're still a good faction. They might not be like S tier, because right now I think they are kind of an S tier warband with all the cover on the board. But they might be more of a, that might be more just like an A tier faction. I think, like I said, Slithale is still one of the greatest fighters in the game. On top of that, factions that were like two dodge or better defense that were just really abusing cover are also going to be hit by this. I mean, I say abusing, it was the way the game worked. So it's not like it's an abusement type thing. But the ones that were really utilizing it the most will probably feel the sting of this change. So things like Ghosts, Mournflight and Wraith Creepers, you know, really love to kind of move on to feature tokens and kind of reap that defensive benefit because they want to stay alive for a really long time. So they might take a small hit, but I think overall everyone's kind of affected by it equally. Like we said, big guy teams will probably get a little bit more out of the move and charge token change than massive fighter teams, but those large number teams also generally like holding objectives, and objectives are a little bit less bad now. So I think it's going to be kind of a weird time for the meta during the transition.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of those comments very well said. I think, you know, obviously Shadeborn are going to struggle, but if anything, it just brings them line to, at worst case, an average warband, which is average warbands still have a very good chance of winning and losing. So I'm pretty agreeable on that front. I do agree as well that, you know, we're going to see maybe some more elite warbands take the stage, which I think is refreshing because we've kind of seen them take a back seat in the latest expansions. You know, we've seen like 4, 5, 6, even 7, and 9 with Gitz teams kind of take center stage here. But it'll be nice to see three man warbands come back in a way, or at least make them more engaged.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe more.
It gives them some flexibility.
Yeah, flexibility is a great word. I do think that we're going to see like some evergreen warbands. Warbands, I think, historically always do well, continue to stay at the top. Like, sure. I think Rippas are in a great place. I think Malog is particularly in a great place because now he can just double charge and keep attacking. So that's something to be on the lookout for. But who knows? We might see some changes there.
Yeah.
I do think that objective strategies are probably, despite the fact that objectives are face side up now, I think a lot of the support for those factions or that play styles are transitioning, you know, in the rotation. And so while we may see some additional support later in the season, it's not necessarily there at the beginning. So I think the game is being geared to a little bit more aggressive. So warbands that can, you know, have that long fight, either end it very quickly or have the resources to stay alive and battle through it, are going to be appealing at first, because I think that's kind of where the idea is going. So if you're a big fan of games like Warcry or Kill Team, where it's just like chop into each other and have brutal fights, then I think these changes are going to resonate with you because the meta is at first leaning in this direction, which I think is super exciting because whenever I've played in my community or locally or in a very casual setting, most people are geared towards like just trying to wipe each other off the board because that's fun.
Yeah.
You know, I think when we get to the like higher levels of competition, you're going to see more nuance and more strategy. But even then, aggro strategies have always been successful, you know?
And they've always been popular as well. I mean, people like rolling dice. People like running forward and seeing their big guy punch another big guy in the face. Like that's just kind of visceral to the game, I think.
Yeah. And some of the best moments are like when a little guy takes down a big guy.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know what? I think that this can happen now.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I think
it could have always happened, but you know,
I think my comment with face up really only applies to a handful of factions that really care about objectives being face up early on, like Starblood Stalkers getting an early inspire, which was difficult before because you had to multi move on and then delve and then not get knocked off was kind of difficult. Mm-hmm. Now you can pretty reliably like burst from the shadows, move, inspire, you're chilling. Things like Grimwatch and Despoilers who have card surge cards that want you to be on objectives that were really hard because you had to, again, move on, delve, and not get punched in the face.
Yeah.
Could be really difficult. Now you can generally multi-push, get on, or, you know, three-move, get on, and kind of hold these objectives, get your glory. And I think some factions will benefit from it more than others.
Yeah, and I agree with both those comments as well on, like, Starblood Stalkers and Grimwatch stocks rising a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a good shout for sure. So cool. I think sounds like the meta is heading in a direction which we're both agreeable with and we're both excited for.
Yeah.
So I think it's a great time to play Underworlds. And so let's continue with talking about some of the additional items in the box set, specifically the boards. Mm-hmm. So there are two double-sided boards, like every starter set in Warhammer Underworlds. And so I'll go through their names very quickly, and then we can talk about each of them. So there's one called the Mist Marsh Tangle, where predatory vapors strip flesh from bone. It's got a very dingy, dark green. And actually, we'll just do them one by one. So let's start with the Mist Marsh Tangle here. So it's very dingy. It's misty, of course. They've got the root system going about. And, you know, we see two blocked hexes and a cover hex. Zach, what do you think about the Mist Marsh Tangle?
This is not a bad board. I mean, there's no lethal, so it's pretty safe to set up, you know, defensively. You've got five starting hexes centralized around blocked hexes, which is, it's a really nice one to kind of set up if you want to cluster your guys early and be safe from long range shooting. It's got that cover token that you can place. It's not on an edge hex, but it's near an edge hex. So if you're a faction that wants to have a cover hex to like push around with Cover of Darkness or teleport to the Shadeborn, you can kind of place that aggressively. I think this is a nice board. Just as kind of like maybe a first one to put out, it feels relatively safe. Also fun to note about this one, you see a lot of these roots and trees with bamboo platforms that are falling around them. Those bamboo platforms are the same ones from the
Warcry.
The new Warcry box. Yeah.
Hardunger.
So it's another little tie back to that earlier discussion we were having about everything being connected now. But good aesthetics and good board. So I like this one a lot.
Yeah, I think it's a great board. The warband that I think about that screams to me when I see this is the Cunning Crew. You have a cover hex there, and everyone's tightly packed in the middle, so you're able to take advantage of the support system that they use. That's kind of their gimmick as a strategy. So that's pretty exciting, I think, for me. I completely agree. This is a pretty decent board that you can place out first. You know, if your strategy is not too aggressive, I think if you've got a pretty... And actually, it works either way, really, because there's, on one side, two hexes in the first row, and then on the other side, there's, you know, two starting hexes in the second row, one in the third row, and one in the first row. So you're right. This is a great board that you can just chuck out there. I also think boards like these are great against fighters that have range 2 and range 3 attacks, because you can kind of dance around the block hexes and make things a little bit more difficult as well.
It might be a little bit bad if you think your opponent's going to longboard you, because there is a a lot of space at the bottom if you're looking at it in the book. But I think if you're fast enough, or you kind of like want to move forward as a united front, that's not necessarily too bad. But just think about what your opponent might do with the board, I think, is the big one here.
It's also advantageous if you place it second and you longboard, right?
Because
then there's a pretty large gap to where your fighters are starting. So
yeah, if you want to be the passive fighter in that situation, absolutely.
Yeah. Cool. I like this one.
It's a good one.
And now we're going to jump to the Visceral Coil, where the Gnarloke's victims are crushed and digested. So
disgusting.
This is a very visceral board, honestly. And I think the name stands. It's like very stark contrast here. So we see the bamboo bridge collapsed. And it looks like these very stark, bright roots. But then also it looks like almost the roots have intestines. And that they're like entrails. And so I guess this is where victims are crushed and digested. And fighters will be fighting here. Now, this board is very interesting in the fact that right in the center of a board, there is a blocked hex, a cover hex, and a lethal hex all next to each other in a sort of triumvirate, position. Zach, I want to get your thoughts on this board.
It's a weird setup. I guess you can use this as kind of like a, if you are putting it down longboard, you can kind of set this up to make a little hallway here where it's hard for your opponent to get to the people behind the cover hex because they have to go past this lethal and past this block hex. Like that space right behind the cover hex, adjacent to the cover and the cover and the blocked, is really, really safe, I think. So if you're if you're playing like a slower faction that wants the long board, this could be a really good one.
You keep talking about longboards. I don't know. What's going on with you, man?
I've been longboarded too many times as Exiled Dead. It keeps attacking me.
Giving people too many bad ideas.
Yeah, I know. but it's a weird one. Like, this is a weird little thing to play around because, like, you don't really want to go there. Maybe if you do an offset, this could be a nice offset for a passive. Much like the long board, where even if you just put the four together, it's a scary thing for your opponent to walk past on their way into your side of the board. So this is a cool one. It's I don't know the sort of the warbands I would take with this, but I could see the situations in which you might want to put this one down.
Sure. Yeah, so a couple things first on the aesthetic. Like, I do think that it's kind of one of the hardest boards to read we've seen thus far.
Yes.
Because like the white blurs with the white of the roots.
Yeah. The white roots with the white lines and the white starting hexes or starting icons all kind of blend together.
They do. So I wish they were a little bit darker maybe, but I think this is a great board to play second if you want to play aggressively. Because if you look at the left side of the board, if you're looking at the rule book, you have three very aggressive starting spots. And behind one of the starting spots is a cover hex. So even if you get distracted, it's still a defensive bonus for you. So I really like how you can place that second, put three fighters right in their front, and go if you want to.
Yeah.
Which is pretty exciting.
Very solid for something like Crushes or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. But ultimately, I don't know if this is a board you're going to want to place first.
No, not at all. I think this is a secondary type of reaction board, whether you're using it aggressively or using it defensively.
Good. Cool. I'm glad we agree on that. So the next one is the Stricken Swamp, where the lifeblood of Gur has spilled onto the surface and stagnated. So this board looks dramatically different from the rest of the boards. It almost looks like it's another season in the fact that it's just black and like a very sickly green here. The poison people that you alluded to from the Warcry box set probably look like they live here.
Yeah.
It's very, very interesting, a very stark difference. And we've got two cover hexes on the board, but I mean, that's really it. So Zach, what are your thoughts on this one?
This is a cool one. I'm looking at where the starting hexes are. This is a safe one, I think, to throw down just because depending on your faction, there's like no edge of the board that's devoid of starting hexes. Like whether your opponent offsets you one way or the other, or longboards you or goes straight on, you can always put at least two fighters to bear and one not too far behind. So if you're an aggro and you're forced to put down the first board, this is actually not a bad one for it. And there's no lethals on here for them to like drive you back into or hurt yourself on. Yeah, this could be a really good aggressive board, because then if you're placing it second, there's even a couple ways you can set this up where you get a really aggressive starting location as well. So this is a, I think this is like a top tier board. Maybe not if you're a hold objective, because I could see some ways that this can get blocked off just based on where the starting hexes and cover hexes are located. You could probably get locked out of your board pretty easily if your opponent is smart with their objective positioning. But for aggro, this is a fantastic board.
Yeah, I think this is another one of those boards that you can place first. I mean, you know, if aside from the objective conundrums that you mentioned, you know, like there are four starting hexes aggressively placed on one side, two on the other. But this can also be one where you want to sit back and you maybe you want to enjoy the benefits of cover. Or not. And I think it's a great all-rounder. I really like it.
Yeah.
It reminds me of, the Mistmarsh Tangle, in that they're both probably boards you want to place first. Whereas the Moltscape, what a name, where the Elder Narlok's bark falls away to reveal their horrific nature, is probably another board that you want to place second, maybe. This has two lethals on it, one on each side of the board, and on the cover hex as well, on one side as well. So, Zach, what are your thoughts on this board? Or if you want me to start, I can start as well.
Why don't you go first this time? Because I went first on the other ones.
Sure, yeah. So this board looks really interesting to me again. Lethal, any board with a lethal hex on it, I'm kind of hesitant about, because I don't ever want to be in a situation where I'm at disadvantage because of the board I picked, right? And so this is one of those boards where I think can be disadvantageous to me, depending, like if I place this first, because then my opponent can place lethals in my way, or maybe positioned to where I have to kind of walk past them. That can be a little demoralizing for you at the beginning of the game. So that's why I think it's a second pick. But if you look at the way the hexes are, they're mostly like midboard. So this can be a great defensive board, I think, for certain players. Especially if they have like a smaller defensive warband. Again, I think like Mournflight or Cunning Crew. But also this is great for warbands who want to maybe be aggressive and utilize the benefit of a cover hex on, you know, the middle of the board. Or it's what's towards one edge, so it'll be towards the middle of the greater board, not just your territory, if you will. And that can be a great spot where you can have maybe like, you know, Thundrick or Lund, you know, move charge two hexes. Stay safely in that cover hex, get that defensive bonus, and maybe take a pot shot. So I really like that as an option. But again, I think this board is better placed second.
I agree, except for hold two factions. If your faction just wants to hold two, or be like a dominant positions type faction, like Mournflight or Dread Pageant, or if you're just like playing heavy path to victory type of thing, I think you can place this first, because either your opponent is going to offset and or longboard, which is generally advantageous for you. And if they offset, they're either putting a lethal in their way to come to you, which is okay. If you're like trying to play hold more, hold two, having a lethal between you and them is, I think, advantageous to you, or they're not putting a lethal in their way because they're offsetting with a cover near the middle of the board. And then you get all your starting hexes like really far away from them and you get to play very defensively. So I think there's a specific type of faction where you're like four or five fighters and you just want to do hold two and make them come to you, that this board can be a first pick. And yeah, your opponent's going to be able to put those lethals where they want them. But I don't think there's a whole lot of, because the lethals are on the edge and not in the middle of the board, and they're not next to any starting hexes except for one that you don't have to go near if you don't want to. There's not a whole lot of ways for them to set this up in such a way that the lethals are bad for a faction like that. So something to think about. I think it, for your faction, you should look at this and kind of consider the setups and if it's something you can just kind of throw down and make your opponent think about.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think that that particular line of warband and that strategy can be beneficial to you in that regard. So yeah, overall, I think these boards are pretty cool. They're different. Certainly things we haven't seen before, which is very exciting. I'm glad that they can continue to make new boards that we haven't seen. And they're not reusing some of the older board setups that we've seen in the past.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that there's a comment you made earlier that I started thinking about halfway through is that, you know, you mentioned one of the boards is not great for objective play. But if you think about it, I think all three of these are again, going to force some clever counter positioning for objectives because mm-hmm. of the fact that you can't place them on, you know, lethal cover or blocked hexes. It just means that there are going to be situations in which I think if you're banking on trying to have two safely in your territory, it's going to be hard to do it with these boards.
Yeah, absolutely. The only one that's really safe for guaranteeing three in your territory is the Miss Marsh Tangle. And all the other ones have ways to get blocked out entirely or at least put in a position that's really, really bad for you. So, I think objective players will probably gravitate toward that one and then only put the other ones out if they're placing second.
Yeah. Yep. Do you have a favorite board, Zach?
Is
that the one, the Mist Marsh Tangle?
Yeah, Mist Marsh for me, just because of what I said about it. But how about you? Because you're a little bit more aggro of a player than I am.
Yeah, easily Visceral Coil.
Mm-hmm.
Just because, like, if I like that's a great Morgox Crushers starting set. Yeah,
absolutely.
What's his name? Storm Sire, Curse Breakers. There's so many great positions there. Even for like a slower warband, if you look at it, you know, you can have Lund, Kazgan, and Thundrick maybe up front, and then maybe Iron Hail on that one up the upper portion of it, and then Allinson safely in the back. I mean, there's so many ways you can set it up to where you can be aggressive if you want to. And I really like it. So those are where we're at with the boards. I think we both think that they're great additions to the game and offer some tactical flexibility, but they might not necessarily be your go-tos.
I will say this. They are both sided. So all four of them are interesting. Maybe you're not going to play them, but they are interesting additions to the game.
Yeah, I definitely agree that Mist Marsh Tangle seems to be the tactically best option.
Mm-hmm.
So I do agree with your comments there.
Strict and Swap's up there too, but yeah.
Yeah, that's true. I like that one. I mean, again, I think both those are great for Cunning Crew. I don't know why that keeps screaming to me. But
yeah, because I think they're a very underrated faction right now.
Yeah, well, depending on who you play against.
Depending on who you ask.
So the last thing I want to point out is that the final back page of the rulebook has the combat sequence, which is a great handy reference that you can access at any time.
Mm-hmm.
It has all the activation options and the turn sequences as well, including reaction steps. And then, of course, the glossary. I mean, it's the biggest glossary we've seen so far. So, you know, 3-4 pages of all the terms that you need, including it referencing the boards as well. So I think if you're ever confused on what something means, like, the last couple pages are essential for you to understand how it works. And if you're one of those groups or communities that likes to play multiplayer games as well, which means more than two, then there are multiplayer rules as well with subtle differences. Like, for example, in multiplayer games, if a fighter gets taken out by a lethal hex, no one gets bounty because there's more than, you know, two players, right?
Yeah. So
small things to think about if that's something you're interested in. But overall, Zach, before we close out the big changes that happen in Gnarlwood, what's your favorite rules change?
For me, I do like the charge token change. I don't know the competitive impact it's going to have, whether it's positive or negative in the long run, but I think it's interesting, and I think it's going to make certain teams feel a little bit more exciting to play. A lot of those 3-man aggro teams, it's the same every time. You draw a card and then you charge, charge, charge. Now it's like you can charge as your first action and then it leads to more interesting situations. And I think that's I think that's going to be a nice change. And other teams are going to be affected overall, obviously. We know we kind of covered it pretty well, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, an interesting thing with that charge change is, like, it also weakens the Gorchos a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
Because, you know, like, they could force a charge, and then now it's like, you can force the charge, potentially take damage from the charge, and your opponent can keep swinging.
Yeah, you know? If it's the last one, because that... Yeah, there was a interesting use where it's like, oh, they only have one fighter left. I'm going to make them charge, and now they're done. But
yeah,
but that I don't think you usually used it near the end because it would cost 3 blood types tokens. You know, you're better off using it early on anyway.
Yeah, but it's just, you know, a niche situation that may have gotten a little bit harder to pull off. But
yeah,
overall, I think that's a great change. I think for me personally, is that. I just kind of like all the changes that remind me of the game as it was, if you will.
Yeah.
So objectives face up. I get to play a power card first if it's my turn. I think that's really nice. It's very nostalgic in a way, mm-hmm. but also fresh because we didn't play it like that for the last year. And then also just the clarifications, man. Like, I think this is probably, you know, a lot of people have said that Dire Chasm at its time was the best season of Underworlds. And then we have Nether Maze, which is like the best season of Underworlds thus far.
Yeah.
Right. And I really do think Gnarlwood can live up to the hype and the expectations. And I think it's going to be the best season of Underworlds so far because it's got everything we really want.
Yeah. And to your point about throwback or nostalgia, or however you want to call it, I think the things they're bringing back are positive things people liked in the past. Like, it's not just changing things to the way they were because, oh, you know, we want to, you know, we don't know what we want to do. We're just going to make changes. It really feels like, hey, these are the changes people liked. Maybe these were changes in the past that, you know, objective side up or, you know, power card order or whatever that people maybe didn't necessarily like or were confused by or whatever. And now we're kind of bringing it back to what people enjoyed and to a time that people were excited to play. So I think that's, I think it's going to be a great change.
Yeah, and even if you are one of the people who enjoyed the rules in Harrow Deep and Nether Maze, mm-hmm. like, this is an exciting challenge for you as a player because you get to play with a rule system that is different.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so you get stimulated in a great way. And if you're someone who started in the beginning of the Underworld's timeline and then kind of dropped off or dipped out or played something else, and maybe you're curious about jumping back in, this is like the perfect time to do so because a lot of that muscle memory is going to kick in. But obviously, you're going to see a lot of differences and updates as well there, which is very exciting. Mm-hmm. And so overall, like, I am super excited about this. Like, I think it's honestly, it's so cool. And I think we're going to see a lot of people like join the game and the game is going to grow because it's almost like throwback to the, you know, the past, but also like revamped, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's all the cool stuff that happened in the past with all the cool stuff that's happening now.
Completely agree. So I think if you're a new player and you're on the fence for Gnarlwood and Warhammer Underworlds, I think this is the perfect opportunity to jump in and join because I think you're going to really have fun. And I think there's a bunch of cool formats that have been introduced into the game and talked about on Warcom that I think are going to be really beneficial to you. I mean, like, Rivals is great for, you know, introductory play. You know, maybe if you're scared of deck building, mm-hmm. if you're concerned with, you know, that skill, or if you've never dealt with it before, you don't have to deck build. Just pick up your faction deck or a Rivals deck that conveniently comes in the box and pick up and play. So you can get your SOs into it. You can get your friends into it. You don't have to pre-build decks. It's all there for you.
Yep.
And if you're looking for a little bit more of a step-up challenge, then you've got the Nemesis format. The Nemesis format is where you can combine your faction deck, your faction rival deck, with any other rival deck that's legal in the format. And again, there's two that are available in the starter set with, I'm sure, you know, more to come, and obviously some that have already released in the past. So at that point, it's like, okay, it's like you can wet your toes and get into deck building. So you can just kind of pick the best cards in your faction, pick the best cards in the particular rival deck that you think have the most synergy with your faction cards, and kind of go from there. And that's super exciting way to play the game. And then once you get to that level where you and your friends or your community like feel comfortable with that, then you can jump to championship where it's like all the cards, the universal cards from all the eligible seasons with your particular faction deck. And that's where you can like really get into that deck building scene if you want to.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't want to, you still have Nemesis and Rivals, which is great. And, you know, I see a lot of events already posting Rivals events. There's been Nemesis events in the UK and Warhammer World that was previously titled Warlord events. So there's been great attendance there. I think if your local scene has stagnated and you're reduced to just playing online, maybe this is a great opportunity for you to set up a launch day event, to do something to where players can all hang out. You can get them into the game and like push a format that maybe you're not the biggest fan of, but eventually if you, you know, invest in your community and you, you know, run those Rivals and Nemesis events, then you're going to have a pretty solid championship scene in a year or two. And that's really exciting if you're willing to put in that effort. I'm certainly going to do that. Zach, I know you're going to do that.
Oh, yeah.
So I think this is an awesome time to join Warhammer Wonderworlds. Like, it's incredible.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with every sentiment you just had there. I mean, Rivals events on day one is great. You can just literally unpack, push fit your minis, and get started. Returning players can just pick up and play. You know, even if you only have Shadespire Warbands, you know, ask to borrow somebody's Daring Delvers out of the box, and you can just put that with your Spike Claw Swarm or with your Eyes of the Nine or something, and just put them on the board, man. You can start playing from second one, and I love that.
Yeah, that's a great concept. You know, like, your buddy bought the new season, you're not sure if you want to, you know, commit to it, you still have your old warbands, you can play.
Yeah,
just pick up and play. Yeah, and one of the biggest things I liked, which we didn't touch on, is that in the commercial on the Warcom article, they said, like, the ultimate competitive board game. And I really like that, because this is going to open up Underworlds to board gamers as well.
Hmm.
And a lot of people who, like, play Underworlds were previously either card players or board gamers, right? Like, and I think for me, like, I love board games, and Underworlds happens to be my favorite game. There is some sort of link there. There's a synergy there.
Sure.
And I think that this is going to open up that market and that community to another community, which will hopefully grow the game.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, cool. I think that's going to do it for all the Gnarlwood updates. Mm-hmm. So very exciting season. Very cool things to talk about. Great setting, great warbands, and a host of brand new rules for older players and newer players to wrap their heads around, which is pretty exciting. And yeah, if you're interested in talking about or listening us talk about some of the Warband or Rival specific reviews, they're going to be on the podcast. They'll just queue up if you're listening on Spotify or iTunes or wherever you listen. But you can also just kind of jump straight to those if you want to, if you are a veteran player. So once again, thanks to all our Patreon supporters. If you want to join our current patrons, you can do so at patreon.com/Path to Glory. You can find all of our blog content on pathtoglorypodcast.com. That's where we're going to have our written reviews as well. Zach and I are splitting them all up, so that's going to be super exciting. And if you have any feedback, you know, questions or comments, let us know on Facebook, Twitter, or at our Discord, which is Path to Glory Podcast. And then, of course, if you are listening on any, you know, sort of podcast hosting software, like, again, Spotify or iTunes, give us a like, give us a thumbs up, give us a rating, you know, so we can kind of spread the word and share this wonderful game with the rest of the community and other communities out there. And honestly, guys, I'm just super excited for Gnarlwood. So, and I know Zach is too.
Yeah.
So absolutely. Thanks for listening to us. Thanks for sharing in the joy of Gnarlwood with us. And we're going to wish you the best of luck in the Gnarlwood on your Path to Glory.